For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. And our next guest on the show today is Dr. Gareth Porter. He's an independent historian and journalist who writes for Interpress Service. And you can find what he writes, almost all of it, pretty much all of it, and, well, yeah, all of it, at original.antiwar.com/Porter. Welcome back to the show, Gareth.
Hello again, Scott.
Hey, welcome back to America, Gareth.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I'm glad to be back.
I'm way over here on the other side of it, but still, I think I can welcome you back.
Sure.
And so where have you been?
Well, I spent 9 days in Kabul trying to get a grip on what's going on in regard to possible peace negotiations in Afghanistan, and also picking up some information about the U.S. Afghan government torture archipelago, if you will, in that country, the continued detention of Afghans without much evidence of a real trial. So anyway, that's the beginning of a series of stories that that I'm just now beginning to work on.
All right. Now, the first story, I guess, was sent in from Afghanistan, right?
That's
behind
right.
Cautious signal of decision for Afghan peace talks, right?
Yes, yes.
And then the brand new one, just out, which if it's not at original.antiwar.com/Porter yet, it will be soon. Let me check and see if we've got it updated here yet. No, not quite yet, but soon enough will be U.S. Karzai clash on unconditional negotiations with Taliban. And, boy, we'll be looking forward to the torture stuff. But let's start with these peace talks with the Taliban. Well, go ahead. I'm all ears.
Well, I mean, these are two stories that that appear to be to represent a contradiction if you read them one after another. And one reading it that way would be, I think, justified in seeing contradictions here. And the reason is that...
Well, I'll admit I was a bit confused.
Well, I think that's a reasonable response to reading two stories. And the fact is that it reflects what appears to be contradictions and confusion within the Obama administration. No real radical difference here between what we already knew and this particular observation. The fact is that the Obama administration does not have a very clear policy. One could say it doesn't have a policy at all toward the question of peace negotiations. But I think that what I should add there is that it really doesn't have a policy toward peace negotiations now, except that it's not very eager for it. Is not really interested in that. It wants to put it off. It wants to put the question off for at least another 18 months until the U.S. military, with its 30,000 more troops in Afghanistan, creates a lot more violence, a lot more civilian casualties, a lot more death in the country in an effort to weaken the Taliban. That much, I think, we know for sure.
So both sides, the Karzai government and the Americans, want to deal with the Taliban, but the Karzai government wants to get going on it, and the Obama government and the generals basically want to wage war for another year and a half and really, you know, stick it to them, Taliban, and weaken them, and then negotiate. Because after all, the Taliban are winning. Why negotiate anything?
Why should the Taliban negotiate, you mean?
Yeah.
I think the answer to that is that the Taliban, as my ISAF source in Kabul told me or acknowledged quite readily, is at the zenith of its power in Afghanistan. For obvious reasons, it has for 3 years now, or 4 years, I guess I should say, been really almost unopposed within a huge swatch of Afghan territory, the entire south, all the way from the Iranian border in the west across to the eastern border with Pakistan in the east. It has had very little opposition for all these years, and now the U.S. is going to try to maximize the military pressure on the Taliban, and I feel that it's very likely that's going to involve, well, we know that it's going to involve a huge increase in what they call nocturnal raids or night raids on villages where they think that they've got some clue as to who the Taliban are. I think in most cases they have very little knowledge about that. And that means it's going to be a huge increase in the number of innocent people swept up and detained. And I think it's also going to mean, in fact, more, not less, use of air power. Regardless of what McChrystal has said and what the policy may have been, it seems to me inevitable that there's going to be a greater use of air power against the Taliban zone, just as there was, or at least in a parallel fashion to the use of air power against the Viet Cong zone in the Vietnam War. I think that's the only way that they're going to be able to somehow claim that they're weakening the Taliban, even though I think the final result is not going to be to reduce support for the Taliban, but to reduce support for the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan. So I think that's the bigger picture.
Yeah, well, and our Quislings.
Yes, exactly.
Well, let me ask you this. Having real talks with the Taliban starting in a year and a half or now, is that the coin doctrine of let's stay for the rest of the century and turn Afghanistan into Iowa or something like that? Or is that the try to get out, declare victory out of our failure and then just go kind of thing, but
that,
wait a little
that
while?
That is indeed the crucial question for us to really try to answer. And I think, I do believe that the answer is more the latter, that there is a tilt inherent in the Obama administration's policy toward an exit strategy rather than a long-term, an effort to maintain a long-term military presence in the country. But I don't think that it is by any means written in stone at this point. I don't think that this administration has on the books anywhere a secret paper that says we are going to get out within X number of months. I think that this administration is so politicized that foreign policy in general and policy toward Afghanistan in particular is such a creature of short-term politics that it is incapable, this president and this administration is incapable of having a firm policy toward that issue. That's really the fundamental problem that we face.
So, well, let me get this straight. You're
so,
telling
yeah,
me
that's
that...
that's a complicated answer, but I hope at least it makes some sense.
Yeah, well, I think I got you, but you tell me if I understand this right. You're
yeah.
saying that the choice is either the long war in Central Asia forever, or maybe not, and they haven't decided yet because it depends on whether they think it'll help them get elected to Congress, next year or whatever.
I think that's a very good way of putting it, yes. I mean, I think that the president would like to, find a way out, and feels that is an important thing to do, but at the same time, he's unwilling to put his stamp of approval on a firm policy that commits him to that.
Well, do you have any indications? I mean, the two indications I know of are the West Point speech where he announced the escalation, and then again, really in the State of the Union, he implied that he really meant something about that July 2011 timeline for the beginning of the end of the war, the beginning of the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. Do you know anything other than just those two public statements that would indicate that there's really any daylight in the policy between what he thinks would be the right thing and what Petraeus thinks would be the right thing?
I mean, the answer is that I have an analysis based on the nature of the decision-making process late last year that suggests something but doesn't provide ironclad proof by any means that the White House really insisted that there be plenty of flexibility, plenty of room for the United States to negotiate out rather than to have a long-term military commitment to Afghanistan. I think that that is clear, that that he wanted that flexibility. So that's a significant data point, but again, does not translate into a firm commitment. I mean, you know, the fact is that this is a president who wings it in large part, or you know, predominantly on the basis of the winds of politics at any particular moment, and that's really problematic in terms of you know, getting to an exit strategy in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. All right, now this guy Hamid Karzai, America's puppet there, installed in 2000, well, really in 2001, and then supposedly elected in 2004. Right, or was it 2005? I think 2004.
2004, and then again.
Yeah, vote Karzai, or we'll burn your house down. That was what it said in the BBC. and now this last time in November there, he stole the election by a million, or at least stole 1.5 million votes, supposedly. The whole thing was a joke. The CIA wanted to bring in this guy, Abdullah Abdullah, to be the new puppet, but then they realized they couldn't even rig an election on behalf of Abdullah Abdullah in any reasonable period of time, and so they just said, forget it, and went ahead and kept Karzai anyway. So I guess, is that an indication to you that there's more and more of a real split between our Quisling Karzai and the American dictatorship? It sounds like in your article here you talk about, well, the occupation. In this article you talk about how he has this conspiracy theory that all of a sudden Karzai thinks that America might have ulterior motives in occupying Afghanistan. But then isn't he the guy that needs us more than anyone to retain his power?
Well, I think he does need U.S. support to remain in power until and unless he can make a deal with the Taliban on terms that would you know, make it possible for him to at least stay to keep some of his power. Is that a credible outcome? I think it is, actually, and I can tell you why. It is a credible scenario. I had an interview with this prominent Afghan political analyst, Harun Mir. He's a very well-educated young fellow who was an aide to the Northern Alliance commander, Massoud, in the 1990s and up to 2001 when Massoud was assassinated by al-Qaeda. And since then, he has sort of set up his think tank in Kabul, and he approaches politics and war from an opposition point of view. He's a political opponent of Karzai. He's a Tajik, a Northern Alliance type, and Karzai, of course, is a Pashtun who is much more into negotiating with the Taliban as a result of that than the Northern Alliance ever would be. And what Harun Mir paints as a possible scenario here is that there is a sort of an Islamist pro-Sharia law cadre within the National Assembly, the legislature of Afghanistan, which is already quite large and is likely to become larger in the next round of elections, and that this group in the legislature could be the basis for a combination of opposition and government party or parties. They're not really parties, but grouplets of legislators who represent both the government and opposition, who could agree on the need to make further changes in the Constitution in the direction of a very sort of harsh Sharia law orientation. Now, this is exactly what the Taliban is going to be demanding in its negotiations with the government. And so the scenario that's being painted here is that there could be an agreement based on further changes in the Constitution, which would move it in the direction of more emphasis on Sharia law. Not something the United States would want to support, but as somebody said to me today, a person in the U.S. Government, are we really interested in fighting for more and more years in Afghanistan to basically support Sharia law in the Afghan constitution? That would appear to be at least one scenario that is not completely unrealistic for a settlement which would give the United States a reason for getting out.
Well, so talk to me about India's power in Afghanistan.
India certainly has a strong role to play in support of the Afghan government and against the Taliban, which it identifies as a movement that is close to the Pakistani government, and that gives India, of course, a reason for taking the other side. Does India have the same kind of influence in Afghanistan that Pakistan does through the Taliban? It doesn't at this point because the United States is a much larger player, obviously. But should the United States decide to pursue an exit strategy, through negotiated settlement, through support for negotiated settlement, as has been pointed out to me, among others, by Harun Mir, there are other actors waiting in the wings to support a war to oppose the Taliban, and that would be Iran, Russia, and India. And that combination, not coincidentally, was precisely the international coalition that supported the Northern Alliance before the United States got into the fight in 2001. So you can see where I'm going with that, that there's a good possibility for a continued civil war, even if the United States does, in fact, make a decision to withdraw over a period of time.
Well, and it's clear that, as of this day, the Pakistanis have an incredible incentive to keep backing the Taliban, that they're letting us bomb inside their country in Iraq, in Afghanistan.
Well, of course, that's the Pakistani Taliban, which is very different from the Afghan Taliban, and I think it's very important. It's more important today than ever before to recognize the difference between those two groups, because the Pakistani Taliban is clearly very close to al-Qaeda, whereas the Afghan Taliban is continuing to move away from its traditional ties with al-Qaeda and with the Pakistani Taliban. I mean, there are...
Well, how many al-Qaeda are even left there, though,
Well, I don't think there are very many al-Qaeda...
I mean, even in Pakistan.
...operatives. Well, I mean, in Pakistan, it's different from Afghanistan. I mean, I don't know the answer to either one of those in specific terms, but I would say that certainly al-Qaeda continues to have a presence in Pakistan, whereas in Afghanistan, I think its presence is very minimal.
Mm-hmm. Well, but still... the larger point about the Pakistanis need the Taliban to control a lot of territory, the Afghan Taliban, if you want to differentiate them that way, is fine with me. But they need their allies in Afghanistan to prevent Karzai and his Indian allies and the rest of them from consolidating power over that country. Because, as Eric Margulies has pointed out, in the event of atomic war with India, the Pakistanis' plan is to retreat into Afghanistan.
No doubt about it in my mind that Pakistan still continues to have the same strategic viewpoint that it's
had
for
decades. And all of these sides are our allies, right? Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, all these guys are our friends.
Well, the United States has always tried to have friendships with both Pakistan and India, going back to the 1950s. And as I think I've mentioned before, I did my master's thesis at the University of Chicago on U.S.-Pakistani relations from the early 1950s up to the mid-1960s. And I was hearing the same arguments, reading the same arguments being made by the U.S. military for cozying up to the Pakistani military during that period that I'm hearing today. that is to say, the Pakistanis will surely see our view of their security interests at some point if we keep giving them enough military toys, particularly advanced air power, that they will lean in our direction in their view of their security interests. But, of course, that's never happened, and it's not going to happen in the future. And so you're right. They are going to continue to view the Taliban as a strategic ally and a major source of influence in Afghanistan, which is regarded as a part of Pakistan's strategic depth in the conflict with India.
All right. And now, I'm sorry, in the last few minutes here, let me get back to what you're saying about the actual possibility of Karzai's plan here to deal with these guys. I mean, are you saying that it's actually a possibility that you could have Mullah Omar and all those guys join the Afghan parliament, or that they would like have a ceasefire in their civil war and more or less secession in Pashtunistan would be created by some kind of peace deal? Or what exactly are you
getting
at with that?
Well, I mean, if you're taking a longer term view, and by longer term I mean, you know, multi-year, I think that that's an inevitable end game to this war, that there will be a political settlement, and that it will take the form of some kind of a negotiated agreement, which includes changes in the Afghan constitution. Now, you know, the most favorable, the most optimistic view that I heard from one of the mediators, an ex-Taliban official who is one of the four people who has been a mediator between Taliban and the Karzai government, was that that the Taliban would not insist on changing more than a very few articles of the present constitution. Now that may be that it's only a few articles, but certainly the Taliban will insist on changes which would be very significant, and which would involve moving away from emphasis on elections and toward the importance of a group of Islamic scholars who would play a key role in making decisions for Afghanistan. That's a major difference between the Taliban and the present constitution, no question about that. But is it imaginable that there could be an agreement in which Islamic scholars would play a bigger role in making fundamental decisions for Afghanistan? I think it is, for the reasons that I've already suggested.
Yeah. Wow. So Karzai is no Maliki, right? This isn't, wouldn't the Taliban insist that the condition, one of their conditions, I mean, or isn't it pretty likely or something that one of their conditions would be American forces have to go if they're going to end the civil war?
That is the clear that there must be a withdrawal within a relatively short period of time of all foreign forces. And what I'm suggesting, I guess, is that, that I think Karzai understands perfectly well that that has to be part of the deal, and he has never said that he is opposed to that condition. I don't know of any statement where he has said I refuse to contemplate an end to Western forces. He has said that the government of Afghanistan would need Western forces there for 5 to 10 years in order to be able to take over security. That's true. But he has also not rejected the idea of a settlement based on a withdrawal of forces on a timetable. So, again, all those things are simply, I would argue, not out of the question. I think it's something that is certainly feasible, it's simply not out of the question that sort of settlement could be reached.
Wow. So let me ask you this, as from a, rather than a journalist, but from a more kind of far-sighted third-person historian perspective.
Yeah.
It really could be that as the American Empire falls, that we go down in history with a legacy of being the great healer of rifts, as people basically cease fire in order to agree to force us out. We're actually bringing former enemies closer together than they've ever been against us.
Well, I mean, I would hesitate to put it in.
I mean,
terms
this is a 30-year civil war, right? You're talking about it coming to an end in the name of getting us out.
I think there are two things going on here. One is that yes, it's very possible that there could be a settlement which would be a reconciliation of at least many elements within Afghan politics and the Taliban. On the other hand, I also think it's very possible that, if not probable, that the military elements associated with the Northern Alliance will reject such a settlement, or will sort of keep their powder dry, and that a war will continue or will resume with the Tajik and other non-Pashtun elements in the National Army and police on one side, and the Taliban on the other side. So, I mean, I think those are two possibilities that are not in opposition to one another, but may, in fact, both be taking place.
So tell me all about what you learned about the torture regime in Afghanistan.
Well, I mean, this is research that is just really beginning. I will tell you that I met with several human rights workers, human rights researchers, including both the semi-official, I would say, Human Rights Commission, which is supposed to be completely independent of the government, but inevitably, is influenced by the Karzai administration in its approach. So I would say semi-independent Human Rights Commission, but also completely independent human rights activists and legal assistance activists who have been working for years to try to get defense lawyers into the system to actually defend people who have been detained by the United States or the Afghan government. And they have made some real progress in this, is what one of the things that I found out, is that there is now, for the first time, for many people who have been detained, a defense lawyer who is helping to get them acquitted. The problem, however, and this is a story that I will do over the next couple of weeks but haven't gotten to yet, is that there are dozens of cases where these detainees have been acquitted, but they're still in jail. The government takes the position that even though they've been acquitted, they're not going to release them. So there you have the contradiction between, on one hand, progress being made in the legal rights of people, on one hand, and the bottom line fact that the Afghan government, presumably with the support of the United States, although I haven't gotten official confirmation of that yet, are simply refusing to let them out of jail, even though they've been acquitted.
Yeah, well, that's the American way now, as we do in Afghanistan, on the outskirts of the empire. So we do in America, as we import this exact same system here, where they say, no matter what, if anybody that they put on trial for September 11th or any terrorism charges, well, if they feel like it, I don't know, I guess they get to pick and choose, just like the Bush years still. But if any of the guys they put on trial for 9/11, they certainly announced, if any of them are acquitted, no problem. We'll still hold them forever, and we'll make up a new term, if not enemy combatant, and still hold them forever. And there are 50 people that they're not even going to give trials because they admit we don't have any evidence against them, but they're still really dangerous.
And that's right. And this,
that's a Guantanamo.
This represents a fundamental problem in the U.S. Political and legal system that we must come to grips with in the coming years. That is that the U.S. military simply refuses to acknowledge that it makes terrible mistakes over and over again, day by day, in picking up innocent people and keeping them in detention for years without giving them minimal due process rights. I had an interview that I began with the deputy commander of something called Task Force 435, which is now responsible for the detention system in Afghanistan, both the U.S. system and for oversight of the Afghan system, which they are now going to be turning prisoners over, detainees over to the Afghan system. And, I did not have sufficient time to ask all the questions I had, so I will, I am insisting on continuing that interview. But I can tell you that the theme that was established very early in the interview is that you know, when I said, what about all these innocent people who you get, you know, who get sort of swept up in your night raids and so forth, this general, General Martins, said to me, well, you know, I don't accept the idea that these people are innocent in legal terms, because their innocence has not been established. In which, at which point I said, okay, well, you know, forget the idea of innocence as a legal concept. The point is that the United States made mistakes and swept up these people who had nothing to do with any crime or with any, you know, violence against the government or United States forces.
Well, and this is just the Rumsfeld standard of truth and logic, which is right. That prove what you haven't done, which is an impossibility.
That's right. And the fact is that this is an evil organization simply by virtue of the fact that they make all these mistakes, they don't know what they're doing, and they refuse to acknowledge that that's the case. And that means that they're going to continue to do evil as long as they're not, you know, pushed out of the country.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate you keeping track of all this stuff for us and going to Afghanistan. I sure wouldn't. I'd be afraid, man. But anyway,
no,
I'm glad
nothing
I can
to be afraid
you.
Of. I can tell you that offensive that took place in Afghanistan, I think the day before, 2 days before I arrived, was a carefully calculated move by the Taliban, which was communicated to the government in advance. The government of Afghanistan.
You're talking about the attacks in Kabul?
The attacks in Kabul. They were communicated. The fact that it was going to happen was communicated to the Afghan government a few days in advance of the attacks. And it was clearly a psychological move by the Taliban to show that even though the government knew it was going to happen in advance, they couldn't do anything about it.
Well, and, you know, some people, I guess it's been a few weeks, maybe it's been more than a month, but there was something, I guess, in the Christian Science Monitor where I think it was the U.S. Army general said that at least at night, the Taliban control 80% of the country.
I've never heard 80% of the country. I don't know if that's accurate. I could certainly say that they control, you know, more than 80% of the Pashtun area of Afghanistan.
At the beginning of the Iraq-style offensive against the insurgents that just creates an even worse problem? I mean,
well, that's what I'm suggesting. That I think that the United States military is in fact, you know, carrying out a military offensive which involves more night raids as well as more use of air power, which is going to antagonize more and more Afghans. I can guarantee you that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, if the Marines are coming, and nobody ever doubted the Marines' ability to kill people.
Yeah.
I mean, or, you know, put firepower on target, as they say, right?
Yeah, there will be more civilian casualties. I think that is a foregone conclusion. We must take that for granted, that that's going to happen.
Yeah, and again, this is all just complete and total incompetence and stupidity, and they really think that what's going to happen is they're going to beat the hell out of the Taliban for a year and a half or so, and then we'll really be in the catbird seat rather than in a much worse position.
Well, I think that's true, that somehow the military must convince itself that all of this is going to somehow, you know, contribute to a better outcome. You know, it was described to me as... By my source in the command, in the International Security Assistance Force command in Kabul, as basically setting the conditions for reconciliation. In other words, this offensive is going to strengthen the bargaining position of the government in its negotiations with the Taliban. That is the new rationale for the war in Afghanistan. It has nothing more to do with Al-Qaeda. I think I can say that is no longer really regarded with any credibility by the U.S. government and the military itself. They no longer believe that the Taliban is somehow married to Al-Qaeda. That's a thing of the past. What they're saying now is that, yeah, this is going to strengthen our negotiation position.
Well, you know, if we could say about Al-Qaeda in Iraq a couple of years ago that they were never more than 2% of the Iraqi insurgency or something. They're certainly a smaller percentage of the insurgency in Afghanistan.
Yeah,
if we're talking about a few hundred Arab Afghans, maybe friends of Osama.
If you're talking about the Taliban per se, then I think it's zero. If you're talking about the Haqqani group then you could make a case that there's some Al Qaeda people certainly seeded into that organization. But they are, you know, a splinter of the overall insurgency. The Taliban, what is called the Taliban proper is certainly 90% of the insurgency in Afghanistan, and that movement simply does not have an Al Qaeda contingent. That it's just not there.
Well, but you know, Petraeus and McChrystal are not Casey and Abizaid, right? I mean, these are the guys who learned the lesson of what a bad job the previous generals had done in Iraq, and they want to not just go around seeking and destroying and blowing things up and creating more enemies, because they're the brainiacs from the Center for New American Security and whatever. They really know what to do. So, pardon me for still not getting this straight here.
Yeah, you can't get it straight because I don't think they have it straight. I think that their position is one that is completely, you know, internally contradictory. On one hand, saying that we must not, you know, do things that are going to antagonize the people, and that is a you know, that is the central issue for counterinsurgency operations in Afghanistan. At the same time, essentially, you know, they know that they have no choice but to go out and do things that, you know, how could they not continue to antagonize people when they do not have adequate intelligence to, you know, simply pick off, you know, people who are Taliban operatives or Taliban leaders? You know, that they simply are incapable of carrying out a clean enough counterinsurgency operation that it will not, you know, harm the interests of massive numbers of civilian Afghans, and that's why I think you know, they are suffering from you know, massive internal confusion and contradiction.
All right, well, you make more sense retelling their story than anybody I know, so I'm going to keep bringing you on the show to explain it, Gareth.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Everybody, that's Dr. Gareth Porter from Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. And he also writes for antiwar.com, original.antiwar.com/Porter. You can find Behind Cautious Signal, A Decision for Afghan Peace Talks, and then the newest one, which will probably be up there by the time most of you hear this part of the interview, at least on MP3, is called U.S. Karzai Clash on Unconditional Negotiations with Taliban. And keep your eyeballs on original.antiwar.com/Porter. for the story about the indefinite detentions for the acquitted there as well. We'll be keeping an eye on that. Thanks again, Gareth.